Side 10, Domes of Fire, The Tomoli, Book 1, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 363. Engesa arrived the next morning with 1,000 Aton clansmen. The faces of their officers clearly showed that Engesa had spoken firmly with them about their failure to be at the clan border at the appointed time. The wounded knights were placed on litters borne by Aton warriors, and the much-enlarged party moved slowly on back to the road and continued eastward toward Libas in Tomel proper. Hindered as they were by the wounded, they did not make good time, or so it seemed. After what had apparently been 2 full days of travel, Sparhawk spoke very briefly with his daughter, advising her that he needed to talk with her at some point while the minds of the others were asleep. When the blank faces of his companions indicated that Afriel was compressing time again, he rode back to the carriage. "Please get right to the point, Sparhawk," the little goddess told him. "It's very difficult this time."
"Is it different somehow?"
"Of course it is. I'm extending the pain of the wounded, and that's very distasteful. I'm making them sleep as much as possible, but there are limits, you know."
"All right, then. How much of what happened back there was real?"
"How could I possibly know that?"
"You mean you can't tell?"
"Well, of course I can't, Sparhawk. When we create an illusion, nobody can tell. It wouldn't be much of an illusion if someone could detect it, would it?"
"You said we. If it was an illusion, there was a god behind it then?"
"Yes, either directly or indirectly. If it was indirectly, though, someone has a great deal of influence with whatever god was involved. We don't surrender that much power very often, or very willingly. Don't beat around the bush, Sparhawk. What's bothering you?"
"I don't really know, Afriel," he confessed. "Something about it didn't seem quite right."
"Specifics, Sparhawk. I need something specific to work with."
"It just seemed to me that it was overdone, that's all. I got a distinct feeling that someone was just showing off. It was adolescent."
She considered that, her bow-like little mouth pouting. "Maybe we are adolescent, Sparhawk. It's one of the dangers of our situation. There's nothing powerful enough to make us grow up, so we're at liberty to indulge ourselves. I've even noticed that in my own character."
"You?"
"Be nice, Father." She said it almost absently, her small black brows knit in concentration. "It's certainly consistent," she added. "Back in Astel, that Saber fellow showed a rather profound lack of maturity, and he was being rather tightly controlled. You may have just hit upon one of our weaknesses, Sparhawk. I'd rather you didn't apply the notion to me directly, but keep the idea that we're all just a bit immature, sort of, in the front of your mind. I won't be able to see it myself, I'm afraid. If it is one of our failings, I'm just as infected with it as the others. We all love to impress each other, and it's polite to be impressed when someone else is showing off." She made a little face. "It's automatic, I'm afraid." "Keep a firm hold on your skepticism, Sparhawk. Your cold-eyed lack of gullibility might be useful. Now please go back to sleep. I'm very busy right now." They crossed the summit of the mountains of Aton and moved on down the eastern slopes toward the border. The demarcation between Aton and Tomel was abrupt and clearly evident. Aton was a wilderness of trees and rugged peaks. Tomel was a carefully tended park. The fields were excruciatingly neat, and even the hills seemed to have been artfully sculpted to provide pleasing prospects and vistas. The peasantry seemed industrious, and they did not have that expression of hopeless misery so common on the faces of the peasants and serfs of Aline kingdoms. "Organization, my dear Emban," Muscania was telling the fat little churchman. "The key to our success lies in organization. All power in Tomel descends from the emperor, and all decisions are made in Matherian. We even tell our peasants when to plant and when to harvest. I'll admit that central planning has its drawbacks, but the Tomel nature seems to require it."
"Elines, unfortunately, are much less disciplined," Emban replied. "The church would be happier with a more docile congregation, but we have to make do with what God gave us to work with." He smiled. "Oh, well, it keeps life interesting."
They reached Rebus late one afternoon. It was a small, neat city, with a distinctly alien-looking architecture that leaned strongly in the direction of artistic embellishment. The houses were low and broad, with graceful roofs that curved upward at the ends of their ridgelines, as if the architects somehow felt that abrupt, straight lines were somehow incomplete. The cobbled streets were broad and straight, and they were filled with citizens dressed in brightly colored silks. The entrance of the Westerners created quite a stir, since the Tamils had never seen Aline knights before. It was the queen of Alenia, however, who astonished them the most. The Tamils were a golden-skinned, dark-haired people, and the pale, blonde queen filled them with awe as her carriage moved almost ceremonially through the streets. Their first concern, of course, was the wounded. Oscania assured them that Tamil physicians were among the finest in the world. It appeared, moreover, that the ambassador held a fairly exalted rank in the empire. A house was immediately provided for the injured knights, and a medical staff seemed to materialize at his command. Additional houses were provided for the rest of their company, and those houses were fully staffed with servants who could not understand a single word of the Alenic language. "You seem to throw a great deal of weight around, Oscania," Amban said that evening, after they had eaten an exotic meal consisting of course after course of unidentifiable delicacies and sometimes startling flavors. "I'm not the overweight one, my friend," Oscania smiled. "My commission is signed by the Emperor, and his hand has the full weight of the entire Derisian continent behind it. He's ordered that all of Tamale do everything possible, and even impossible, to make the visit of Queen Elana pleasant and convenient. No one ever disobeys his orders."
"They must not have reached the trolls, then," Ulaf said blandly. "Of course, trolls have a different view of the world than we do. Maybe they thought Queen Elana would be entertained by their welcome."
"Does he have to do that?" Oscania complained to Sparhawk.
"Ulaf? Yes, I think he does, Your Excellency. It's something in the Thalesian nature, terribly obscure, I'm afraid, and quite possibly perverted."
"Sparhawk!"
Ulaf protested.
"Nothing personal there, old boy," Sparhawk grinned. "Just a reminder that I haven't yet quite forgiven you for all the times you've euchred me into doing the cooking when it wasn't really my turn."
"Hold still," Mirtai commanded.
"You got some of it in my eye," Talon accused her.
"It won't hurt you. Now hold still." She continued to daub the mixture onto his face.
"What is that, Mirtai?"
Baroness Melodir asked curiously.
"Saffron. We use it in our cooking. It's a kind of a spice."
"What are we doing here?" Elana asked curiously, as she and Sparhawk entered the room to find the Etana spreading the condiment over Talon's face.
"We're modifying your page, my queen," Stragan explained. "He has to go out into the streets, and we want him to be unobtrusive. Mirtai's changing the color of his skin."
"You could do that with magic, couldn't you, Sparhawk?" Elana asked.
"Probably," he said. "And if I couldn't, Sephrenia certainly could."
"Now you tell me," Talon said in a slightly bitter tone. "Mirtai's been seasoning me for the past half hour."
"You smell good, though," Melodir told him.
"I didn't set out to be somebody's supper. Ouch!"
"Sorry," Aileen murmured, carefully disengaging her comb from a snarl in his hair. "I have to work the dye in, though, or it won't look right." Aileen was applying black dye to the young man's hair.
"How long will it take me to wash this yellow stuff off?" Talon asked.
"I'm not sure," Mirtai shrugged. "It might be permanent, but it should wear off in a month or so."
"I'll get you for this, Stragan," Talon threatened.
"Hold still," Mirtai said again, and continued her daubing.
"We have to make contact with the local thieves," Stragan explained. "The thieves at Sarsos promised that we'd get a definite answer here in Libus."
"I see a large hole in the plan, Stragan," Sparhawk replied. "Talon doesn't speak Tamil."
"That's no real problem," Stragan shrugged. "The chief of the local thieves is a Camorian."
"How did that happen?"
We are very cosmopolitan, Sparhawk. All thieves are brothers, after all, and we recognize the aristocracy of Talon. Anyway, as soon as he can pass for a Tamil, Talon's going to the local thieves' den to talk with Ka'alador. That's the Camorian's name. He'll bring him here, and we'll be able to talk with him privately.
Why aren't you the one who's going?
And get saffron all over my face? Don't be silly, Sparhawk.
Ka'alador the Camorian was a stocky, red-faced man with curly black hair and an open, friendly countenance. He looked more like a jovial innkeeper than a leader of thieves and cutthroats. His manner was bluff and good-humored, and he spoke in the typical Camorian drawl and with a slovenly grammar that bespoke backcountry origins.
So you're the one who's got all the thieves of Daresia so sore perplexed, he said to Strachan when Talon presented him.
I'll have to plead guilty on that score, Ka'alador, Strachan smiled.
Don't never do that, brother. Allus try and lie your way out in things.
I'll try to remember that. What are you doing so far from home, my friend?
I mought ax you the same question, Strachan. It's a fur piece from here to Thalesia,
and quite nearly as far from Camoria.
Aw, that's easy explained, my friend. I started out in life as a poacher, catching rabbits and sich in the bushes on land that weren't rightly mine. But that's a sore, hard kind of work with lots of risk and mighty slim profit. So I took to lifting chickens out in hen roosts, chickens not running near as fast as rabbits, especially at night. Then I moved up to sheep stealing. Only one night I had me a set to with a whole passel of sheep dogs, which it was as betrayed me real cruel by not staying bribed.
How do you bribe a dog? Alana asked curiously.
Easiest thing in the world, little lady. You thrun 'em some meat scraps to keep their attention. Well, sir, then their dogs tore into me something fierce, and I lit out, leaving, misfortune-like, a hat which it was I was partial to, and which it was as could be recognized as mine by half the parish. Now, I'm just a country boy at heart, without no real citified ways to get me by in town, and so I took him to sea. And to make it short, I fetched up on this year Fern Coast and beat my way inland, the captain of the ship I was a-sailing on wanting to talk to me about some stuff as had turned up missing from the cargo hold, you know. He paused.
Have I sufficiently entertained you as yet, my Lord Strachan?
He grinned.
Very, very good, Ka'alador, Strachan murmured. Convincing, although it was a trifle overdone.
A failing, my lord. It's so much fun that I get carried away. Actually, I'm a swindler. I've found that posing as an ignorant yokel disarms people. No one in this world is as easy to gull as the man who thinks he's smarter than you are.
Oh! Elana's tone was profoundly disappointed.
Was your majesty tooken with the ignorant way I was a-talkin'?
Ka'alador asked sympathetically.
I'll do her again if you're of a mind.
Of course, it takes a beastly long time to get to the point that way.
She laughed delightedly. I think you could charm the birds out of the bushes, Ka'alador, she told him.
Thank you, your majesty, he said,
bowing with fluid grace. Then he turned back to Strachan. Your proposal has baffled our Tamil friends, my lord, he said. The demarcation line between corruption and outright theft is very clearly defined in the Tamil culture. Tamil thieves are quite class-conscious, and the notion of actually cooperating with the authorities strikes them as unnatural for some reason. Fortunately, we Alenes are far more corrupt than our simple yellow brothers, and Alenes seem to rise to the top in our peculiar society. Natural talent, most likely. We saw the advantages of your proposal immediately. Kondrak of Darsus was most eloquent in his presentation. You seem to have impressed him enormously. The disturbances here in Tamale have been disastrous for business, and when we began reciting profit and loss figures to the Tamils, they started to listen to reason. They agreed to cooperate. Grudgingly, I'll grant you,
but they will help you to gather information.
Thank God, Strachan said with a vast sigh of relief. The delay was beginning to make me nervous.
You'd made promises to your queen, and you wasn't sure if and you could deliver, is that it?
That's very, very close, my friend.
I'll give you the names of some people in Metherion. Kaalador looked around. Private-like, if and you take my meaning. He added, it's all very well to talk about lending a helping hand and sich, but tain't hardly natural to be naming no names right out in front of no queens and knights and sich. He grinned impudently at Aelana. And now, your queenship, how'd you like it if and I was to spin you a long, long tale about my adventures in the shadowy world of crime?
I'd be delighted, Kaalador, she replied eagerly. Another of the injured knights died that night, but the 24 sorely wounded seemed on the mend. As Oscania had told them, Tamil physicians were extraordinarily skilled, although some of their methods were strange to Aline's. After a brief conference, Sparhawk and his friends decided to press on to Metherion. Their trek across the continent had yielded a great deal of information, and they all felt that it was time to combine that information with the findings of the Imperial government. And so they set out from Libus early one morning and rode south under a kindly summer sky. The countryside was neat, with crops growing in straight lines across weedless fields marked off with low stone walls. Even the trees in the woodlands grew in straight lines, and all traces of unfettered nature seemed to have been erased. The peasants in the fields wore loose-fitting trousers and shirts of white linen and tightly woven straw hats that looked not unlike mushroom tops. Many of the crops grown in this alien countryside were unrecognizable to the Alenes, odd-looking beans and peculiar grains. They passed Lake Sama and saw fishermen casting nets from strange-looking boats with high prows and sterns, boats of which Khalad profoundly disapproved.
One good gust of wind from the side would capsize them, was his verdict.
They reached Tosa, some 60 leagues to the north of the capital, with that sense of impatience that comes near the end of every long journey. The weather held fair, and they set out early and rode late each day, counting off every league put behind them. The road followed the coast of the Tamil Sea, a low, rolling coastline, where rounded hills rose from broad beaches of white sand, and long waves rolled in to break and foam and slither back out into deep blue water. 8 days, more or less, after they left Tosa, they set up for the night in a park-like grove with an almost holiday air, since Oscania assured them that they were no more than 5 leagues from Metherion.
We could ride on, Calton suggested. We'd be there by morning.
Not on your life, Sir Calton, Aelana said adamantly. Start heating water, gentlemen, and put up a tent we can use for bathing. The ladies and I are not going to ride into Metherion with half the dirt of Derija kicked on us, and string some lines so that we can hang our gowns out to air and to let the breeze shake the wrinkles out of them.
She looked around critically.
And then, gentlemen, I want you to see to yourselves and your equipment. I'll inspect you before we set out tomorrow morning, and I'd better not find one single speck of rust.
Calton sighed mournfully.
Yes, my queen, he replied in a resigned tone of voice.
They set out the following morning in a formal column with the carriage near the front. Their pace was slow to avoid raising dust, and Aelana, gowned in blue and crowned with gold and diamonds, sat regally in the carriage, looking for all the world as if she owned everything in sight. There had been one small but intense disagreement before they set out, however. Her Highness the Royal Princess Danae had objected violently when told that she would wear a proper dress and a delicate little tiara. Aelana did not cajole her daughter about the matter, but instead she did something she had never done before. "Princess Danae," she said quite formally, "I am the queen. You will obey me."
Danae blinked in astonishment. Sparhawk was fairly certain that no one had ever spoken to her that way before.
"Yes, Your Majesty," she replied finally, in a suitably submissive tone. Word of their approach had preceded them, of course,
and Gessa had seen to that, and as they rode up a long hill about mid-afternoon, they saw a mounted detachment of ceremonial troops wearing armor of black lacquered steel, inlaid with gold, awaiting them at the summit. The honor guard was drawn up in ranks on each side of the road. There were as yet no greetings, and when the column crested the hill, Sparhawk immediately saw why. "Dear God," Bevier breathed in awed reverence. A crescent-shaped city embraced a deep blue harbor below. The sun had passed its zenith, and it shone down on the crown of Tomoli. The architecture was graceful, and every building had a dome-like, rounded roof. It was not so large as Kyrellos, but it was not the size that had wrung that reverential gasp from Sir Bevier. The city was dazzling, but its splendor was not the splendor of marble. An opalescent sheen covered the capital, a shifting rainbow-hued fire that blazed beneath the surface of its very stones, a fire that at times blinded the eye with its stunning magnificence. "Behold," Oscania intoned quite formally, "behold the seat of beauty and truth. Behold the home of wisdom and power. Behold fire-domed Mathurian, the center of the world." Part 4. Mathurian. Chapter 24. "It's been that way since the 12th century," Ambassador Oscania told them, as they were escorted down the hill toward the gleaming city. "Was it magic?" Talon asked him. The young thief's eyes were filled with wonder. "You might call it that," Oscania said wryly. "But it was the kind of magic one performs with unlimited money and power, rather than with incantations. The 11th and 12th centuries were a foolish period in our history. It was the time of the Mycene dynasty, and they were probably the silliest family ever to occupy the throne. The first Mycene emperor was given an ornamental box of mother-of-pearl, or nacre, as some call it, by an emissary from the Isle of Tiga, when he was about 14 years old. History tells us that he would sit staring at it by the hour, paralyzed by the shifting colors. He was so enamored of the nacre, he had his throne sheathed in the stuff."
"That must have been a fair-sized oyster," Ulath noted.
Oscania smiled. "No, Sir Ulath. They cut the shells into little tiles and fit them together very tightly. Then they polish the whole surface for a month or so. It's a very tedious and expensive process. Anyway, the second Mycene emperor took it one step further and sheathed the columns in the throne room. The third sheathed the walls, and on and on and on. They sheathed the palace, then the whole royal compound. Then they went after the public buildings. After 200 years, they'd cemented those little tiles all over every building in Mathurian. There are low dives down by the waterfront that are more magnificent than the Basilica of Kyrellos. Fortunately, the dynasty died out before they paved the streets with it. They virtually bankrupted the empire and enormously enriched the Isle of Tiga in the process. Tegan divers became fabulously wealthy, plundering the seafloor."
"Isn't Mother of Pearl almost as brittle as glass?"
Khalad asked him. "It is indeed, young sir, and the cement that's used to stick it to the buildings isn't all that permanent. A good windstorm fills the streets with gleaming crumbs and leaves all the buildings looking as if they've got the pox. As a matter of pride, the tiles have to be replaced. A moderate hurricane can precipitate a major financial crisis in the empire, but we're saddled with it now. Official documents have referred to fire-domed Mathurian for so long that it's become a cliché. Like it or not, we have to maintain this absurdity."
"It is breathtaking, though," Elana marveled in a slightly speculative tone of voice.
"Never mind, dear," Sparhawk told her quite firmly.
"What?"
"You can't afford it. Lenda and I almost come to blows every year hammering out the budget as it is."
"I wasn't seriously considering it, Sparhawk," she replied. "Well, not too seriously, anyway," she added.
The broad avenues of Mathurian were lined with cheering crowds that fell suddenly silent as Elana's carriage passed. The citizens stopped cheering as the Queen of Alenia went by, because they were too busy groveling to cheer. The formal grovel, involved kneeling and touching the forehead to the paving stones.
"What are they doing?" Elana exclaimed.
"Obeying the Emperor's command, I'd imagine," Oscania replied. "That's the customary sign of respect for the Imperial person."
"Make them stop,"
she commanded. "Countermand an Imperial order? Me, Your Majesty? Not very likely. Forgive me, Queen Elana, but I like my head where it is. I'd rather not have it displayed on a pole at the city gate. It is quite an honor, though. Sarabians ordered the population to treat you as his equal. No emperor's ever done that before."
"And the people who don't fall down on their faces are punished?"
Khalad surmised with a hard edge to his voice. "Of course not. They do it out of love. That's the official explanation, of course. Actually, the custom originated about 1,000 years ago. A drunken courtier tripped and fell on his face when the emperor entered the room. The emperor was terribly impressed, and, characteristically, he completely misunderstood. He awarded the courtier a dukedom on the spot. People aren't banging their faces on the cobblestones out of fear, young man. They're doing it in the hope of being rewarded."
"You're a cynic, Oscania," Emban accused the ambassador.
"No, Emban, I'm a realist. A good politician always looks for the worst in people."
"Someday they may surprise you, Your Excellency," Talon predicted.
"They haven't yet." The palace compound was only slightly smaller than the city of Demos in eastern Alenia. The gleaming central palace, of course, was by far the largest structure on the grounds. There were other palaces, however, glowing structures in a wide variety of architectural styles. Sir Bevier drew in his breath sharply.
"Good Lord," he exclaimed, "that castle over there is almost an exact replica of the palace of King Dragos in Larium."
"Plagiarism appears to be a sin not exclusively committed by poets," Stragan murmured.
"Merely a genuflection toward cosmopolitanism, my lord," Oscania explained. "We are an empire, after all, and we've drawn many different peoples under our roof. Alenes like castles, so we have a castle here to make the Alene kings of the Western Empire feel more comfortable when they come to pay a call. The castle of King Dragos certainly doesn't gleam in the sun the way that one does," Bevier noted.
"That was sort of the idea, Sir Bevier," Oscania smiled.
They dismounted in the flagstoned, semi-enclosed court before the main palace, where they were met by a horde of obsequious servants.
"What does he want?"
Calton asked, holding off a determined-looking Tommel garbed in crimson silk.
"Your shoes, Sir Calton," Oscania explained.
"What's wrong with my shoes?"
"They're made of steel, Sir Knight."
"So? I'm wearing armor. Naturally my shoes are made of steel."
"You can't enter the palace with steel shoes on your feet. Leather boots aren't even permitted. The floors, you understand."
"Even the floors are made of seashells?" Calton asked incredulously.
"I'm afraid so. We Tamils don't wear shoes inside our houses, so the builders went ahead and tiled the floors of the buildings here in the Imperial compound, as well as the walls and ceilings. They didn't anticipate visits by armored knights."
"I can't take off my shoes," Calton objected, flushing.
"What's the problem, Calton?" Elana asked him.
"I've got a hole in one of my socks," he muttered, looking dreadfully embarrassed. "I can't meet an emperor with my toes hanging out."
He looked around at his companions, his face pugnacious. He held up one gauntleted fist.
"If anybody laughs, there's going to be a fight," he threatened.
"Your dignity's secure, Sir Calton," Oscania assured him. "The servants have down-filled slippers for us to wear inside."
"I've got awfully big feet, Your Excellency," Calton pointed out anxiously. "Are you sure they'll have shoes to fit me?"
"Don't be concerned, Calton Knight," Engessa said. "If they can fit me, they can certainly fit you."
Once the visitors had been reshod, they were escorted into the palace. There were oil lamps hanging on long chains suspended from the ceiling, and the lamplight set everything aflame. The shifting, rainbow-hued colors of the walls, floors, and ceiling of the broad corridors dazzled the Alenes, and they followed the servants all bemused. There were courtiers here, of course. No palace is complete without them. and, like the citizens in the streets outside, they groveled as the Queen of Alenia passed.
"Don't become too enamored of their mode of greeting, love," Sparhawk warned his wife. "The citizens of Simura wouldn't adopt it no matter what you offered them."
"Don't be absurd, Sparhawk," she replied tartly. "I wasn't even considering it. Actually, I wish these people would stop. It's really just a bit embarrassing."
"That's my girl," he smiled.
They were offered wine and chilled, scented water to dab on their faces. The knights accepted the wine enthusiastically, and the ladies dutifully dabbed. "You really ought to try some of this, father," Princess Danae suggested, pointing at one of the porcelain basins of water. "It might conceal the fragrance of your armor."
"She has a point, Sparhawk," Elana agreed. "Armor is supposed to stink," he replied, shrugging. "If an enemy's eyes start to water during a fight, it gives you a certain advantage."
"I knew there was a reason," the little princess murmured. Then they were led into a long corridor, where mosaic portraits were inlaid into the walls. Stiff, probably idealized representations of long-dead emperors. A broad strip of crimson carpet with a golden border along each edge protected the floor of that seemingly endless corridor.
"Very impressive, Your Excellency," Stragan murmured to Oscania after a time. "How many more miles is it to the throne room?"
"You are droll, milord," Oscania smiled briefly.
"It's artfully done," the thief observed. "But doesn't it waste a great deal of space?"
"Very perceptive, milord Stragan."
"What's this?" Tinian asked. "The corridor curves to the left," Stragan replied. "It's hard to detect because of the way the walls reflect the light, but if you look closely, you can see it. We've been walking around in a circle for the past quarter of an hour."
"A spiral, actually, milord Stragan," Oscania corrected him. "The design was intended to convey the notion of immensity. Tamils are of short stature, and immensity impresses us. That's why we're so fond of the Aetons. We're reaching the inner coils of the spiral now. The throne room's not far ahead." The corridors of shifting fire were suddenly filled with a brazen fanfare as hidden trumpeters greeted the queen and her party. That fanfare was followed by an awful screeching, punctuated by a tinny clanking noise. Myrrh nestled in her little mistress' arms, laid back her ears, and hissed. "The cat has excellent musical taste," Bevier noted, wincing at a particularly off-key passage in the music. "I'd forgotten that," Sophronia apologized to Vanyan. "Try to ignore it, dear one."
"I am," he replied with a pained expression on his face. "You remember that ogress I told you about?" Ulof asked Sparhawk. "The one who fell in love with that poor fellow up in Thalesia?" "Vaguely. When she sang to him, it sounded almost exactly like that." "He went into a monastery to get away from her, didn't he?" "Yes." "Wise decision."
"It's an affectation of ours," Oscania explained to them. "The Tamil language is very musical when it's spoken. Pretty music would seem commonplace, even mundane. So our composers strive for the opposite effect." "I'd say they've succeeded beyond human imagination," Baroness Melodier said. "It sounds like someone's torturing a dozen pigs inside an ironworks." "I'll convey your observation to the composer, Baroness," Oscania told her. "I'm sure he'll be pleased."
"I'd be pleased if his song came to an end, Your Excellency."
The vast doors that finally terminated the endless seeming corridor were covered with beaten gold, and they swung ponderously open to reveal an enormous domed hall. Since the dome was higher than the surrounding structures, the illumination in the room came through inch-thick crystal windows high overhead. The sun poured down through those windows to set the walls and floor of Emperor Sarabian's throne room afire. The hall was of suitably stupendous dimensions, and the expanses of nacreous white were broken up by accents of crimson and gold. Heavy red velvet draperies hung at intervals along the glowing walls, flanking columnar buttresses inlaid with gold. A wide avenue of crimson carpet led from the huge doors to the foot of the throne, and the room was filled with courtiers, both Tamil and Aline. Another fanfare announced the arrival of the visitors.
and the church knights and the Poloi formed up in military precision around Queen Elana and her party. They marched with ceremonial pace down that broad, carpeted avenue to the throne of His Imperial Majesty, Sarabian of Tamil. The ruler of half the world wore a heavy crown of diamond-encrusted gold, and his crimson cloak, open at the front, was bordered with wide bands of tightly woven gold thread. His robe was gleaming white, caught at the waist by a wide golden belt. Despite the splendor of his throne room and his clothing, Sarabian of Tamil was a rather ordinary-looking man. His skin was pale by comparison with the skin of the Etons, largely, Sparhawk surmised, because the Emperor was seldom out of doors. He was of medium stature and build, and his face was unremarkable. His eyes, however, were far more alert than Sparhawk had expected. When Elana entered the throne room, he rose somewhat hesitantly to his feet. Oscania looked a bit surprised. "That's amazing," he said. "The Emperor never stands to greet his guests." "Who are the ladies gathered around him?" Elana asked in a quiet voice. "His wives," Oscania replied. "The Empresses of Tamuli. There are 9 of them."
"Monstrous," Vivier gasped.
"Political expediency, Sir Knight," the ambassador explained. "An ordinary man has only 1 wife, but the Emperor has to have 1 from each kingdom in the Empire. He can't really show favoritism, after all."
"It looks as if one of the Empresses forgot to finish dressing,"
Baroness Melodir said critically, staring at one of the Imperial wives, a sunny-faced young woman who stood naked to the waist, with no hint that her unclad state caused her any concern. The skirt caught around her waist was a brilliant scarlet, and she had a red flower in her hair. Oscania chuckled. "That's our Elisoon," he smiled. "She's from the Isle of Valesia, and that's the costume, or lack of it, customary among the islanders. She's a totally uncomplicated girl, and we all love her dearly. The normal rules governing marital fidelity have never applied to the Valesian Empress. It's a concept the Valesians can't comprehend. The notion of sin is alien to them." Bevier gasped.
"Hasn't anyone ever tried to instruct them?" Amban asked.
"Oh my, yes, Your Grace," Oscania grinned. "Churchmen from the Aline kingdoms of Western Tamale have gone by the score to Valesia to try to persuade the islanders that their favorite pastime is scandalous and sinful. The churchmen are filled with zeal right at first, but it doesn't usually last for very long. Valesian girls are all very beautiful and very friendly. Almost invariably, it's the Alines who are converted. The Valesian religion seems to have only 1 commandment. Be happy."
"There are worse notions," Amban sighed.
"Your Grace," Bevier exclaimed.
"Grow up, Bevier," Amban told him. "I sometimes think that our Holy Mother Church is a bit obsessive about certain aspects of human behavior."
Bevier flushed, and his face grew rigidly disapproving. The courtiers in the throne room, obviously at the Emperor's command, once again ritualistically groveled as Elana passed. Practice had made them so skilled that dropping to their knees, banging their foreheads on the floor, and getting back up again was accomplished with only minimal awkwardness. Elana, gowned in royal blue, reached the throne and curtsied gracefully. The set look on her face clearly said that she would not grovel. The Emperor bowed in response, and an astonished gasp ran through the crowd. The Imperial bow was adequate, though just a bit stiff. Sarabian had obviously been practicing, but bowing appeared not to come naturally to him. Then he cleared his throat and spoke at some length in the Tamil language, pausing from time to time to permit his official translator to convert his remarks into Alenic.
"Keep your eyes where they belong,"
Elana murmured to Sparhawk. Her face was serene, and her lips scarcely moved.
"I wasn't looking at her," he protested.
"Oh, really?" The Empress Elisoon had the virtually undivided attention of the church knights and the Poloi, and she quite obviously was enjoying it. Her dark eyes sparkled, and her smile was just slightly naughty. She stood not far from her Imperial husband, breathing deeply,
evidently a form of exercise among her people. There was a challenge in the look she returned to her many admirers, and she surveyed them clinically. Sparhawk had seen the same look on Ilana's face when she was choosing jewelry or gowns. He concluded that Empress Elisun was very likely to cause problems. Emperor Sarabian's speech was filled with formalized platitudes. His heart was full. He swooned with joy. He was dumbstruck by Ilana's beauty. He was quite overwhelmed by the honor she did him in stopping by to call. He thought her dress was very nice. Ilana, the world's consummate orator, quickly discarded the speech she had been preparing since her departure from Kyrellus, and responded in kind. She found Mathurian quite pretty. She advised Sarabian that her life had now seen its crown. Ilana's life seemed to find a new crown each time she made a speech. She commented on the unspeakable beauty of the imperial wives, though making no mention of Empress Elisun's painfully visible attributes. She also promised to swoon with joy, since it seemed to be the fashion here. She thanked him profusely for his gracious welcome. She did not, however, talk about the weather. Emperor Sarabian visibly relaxed. He had clearly been apprehensive that the Queen of Alenia might accidentally slip something of substance into her speech, which would have then obliged him to respond without consultation. He thanked her for her thanks. She thanked him for his thanks for her thanks. Then they stared at each other. Thanks for thanks can only be carried so far without becoming ridiculous. Then an official with an exaggeratedly bored look on his face cleared his throat. He was somewhat taller than the average Tamil, and his face showed no sign whatsoever of what he was thinking. It was with enormous relief that Emperor Sarabian introduced his prime minister, Pandya Subat. "Odd name," Uloth murmured after the emperor's remarks had been translated. "I wonder if his close friends call him Pandi."
"Pandya is his title of nobility, Sir Uloth," Oscania explained. "It's a rank somewhat akin to that of Viscount, though not exactly. Be a little careful of him, my lords. He is not your friend. He also pretends not to understand Alenic, but I strongly suspect that his ignorance on that score is feigned." Subat was violently opposed to the idea of inviting Prince Sparhawk to come to Mathurian. He felt that to do so would demean the Emperor. "I've also been advised that the Emperor's decision to treat Queen Ilana as an equal quite nearly gave our Prime Minister apoplexy."
"Is he dangerous?" Sparhawk murmured.
"I'm not entirely certain, Your Highness. He's fanatically loyal to the Emperor, and I'm not altogether sure where that may lead him."
Pandya Subat was making a few remarks.
"He says that he knows you're fatigued by the rigors of the journey," Oscania translated. "He urges you to accept the imperial hospitality to rest and refresh yourselves. It's a rather neat excuse to conclude the interview before anyone says anything that might compel the Emperor to answer before Subat has a chance to prompt him."
"It might not be a bad idea," Ilana decided. "Things haven't gone badly so far. Maybe we should just leave well enough alone for the time being."
"I shall be guided by you, Your Majesty," Oscania said with a florid bow. Ilana let that pass. After another effusive exchange between their majesties, the Prime Minister escorted the visitors from the hall. Just outside the door to the throne room, they mounted a flight of stairs and proceeded along a corridor directly to the far side of the palace, foregoing the pleasure of retracing their steps around and around the interminable spiral. Pandya Subat, speaking through an interpreter, pointed out features of interest as they progressed. His tone was deliberately offhand, treating wonders as commonplace. He was not even particularly subtle about his efforts to put these Alene barbarians in their place. He did not quite sneer at them, but he came very close. He led them along a covered walkway to the gleaming Alene castle, where he left them in the care of Ambassador Oscania.
"Is his attitude fairly prevalent here in Mathurian?" Amban asked the ambassador.
"Hardly," Oscania replied. "Subat's the leader of a very small faction here at court. They're arch-conservatives, who haven't had a new idea in 500 years.
How did he become Prime Minister, if his faction is so small? Tinian asked.
Tamil politics are very murky, Sir Tinian. We serve at the Emperor's pleasure, and he's in no way obliged to take our advice on any matter. Subhat's father was a very close friend of Emperor Sarabian's sire, and the appointment of Subhat as Prime Minister was more in the nature of a gesture of filial respect than a recognition of outstanding merit, although Subhat's an adequate Prime Minister, unless something unusual comes up. Then he tends to go all to pieces. Cronyism's one of the major drawbacks of our form of government. The head of our church has never had a pious thought in his life. He doesn't even know the names of our gods. Wait a minute, Emban said, his eyes stunned. Are you trying to say that ecclesiastical positions are bestowed by the emperor? Of course. They are positions of authority, after all, and Tamil emperors don't like to let authority of any kind out of their hands. They had entered the main hall of the castle, which, with the exception of the gleaming nacre that covered every exposed surface, was very much like the main hall of every Aline castle in the world. The servants here are Alines, Oscania told them, so you should have no difficulty explaining your needs to them. I trust you'll excuse me now. I must go make my report to His Imperial Majesty. He made a face. I'm not really looking forward to it, to be honest with you. Subhat's going to be standing at His Majesty's elbow, making light of everything I say. He bowed to Aelana, then turned and left.
We've got problems here, I think, Tinian observed. All this formality is going to keep us away from the Emperor, and if we can't tell him what we've discovered, he's not likely to give us the freedom of movement we're going to need.
And the antagonism of the Prime Minister is going to make things that much worse, Bevier added. It rather looks as if we've come halfway around the world to offer our help, only to be confined in this very elaborate prison. Let's feel things out a bit before we start getting obstreperous, Emban counseled. Oscania knows what he's doing, and he's seen almost everything we've seen. I think we can count on him to convey the urgency of the situation to Sarabian.
If you have no need of us, Your Majesty, Stragan said to Aelana, Talon and I should go make contact with the local thieves. If we're going to be tied up in meaningless formalities here, we'll need some help in gathering information.
How do you plan to communicate with them? Khalad asked him.
Mathurian's a very cosmopolitan place, Khalad. Ka'alador directed me to several Alines who carry quite a bit of weight with the local thieves.
Do what you must, Stragan, Aelana told him, but don't cause any international incidents.
Trust me, Your Majesty.
He grinned.
The royal apartment in the castle was high up in a central tower. The castle was purely ornamental, of course, but since it was a faithful reproduction of an Aline fort, the builders had unwittingly included practical features they probably hadn't even recognized. Bevier was quite pleased with it. I could defend the place, he judged. About all I'd need would be a few vats of pitch and some engines, and I could hold this castle for several years. Let's hope it doesn't come to that, Bevier, Aelana replied. Later that evening, when Sparhawk and his extended family had said good night to the others and retired to the royal apartment, the prince consort lounged in a chair by the window, while the ladies did all those little things ladies do before going to bed. Many of those little ceremonies had clearly practical reasons behind them. Others were totally incomprehensible. I'm sorry, Sparhawk, Aelana was saying, but it concerns me. If the Empress Elisun's as indiscriminately predatory as Oscania suggests, she could cause us a great deal of embarrassment. Take Colton, for example. Can you believe that he'd decline the kind of offers she's likely to make, particularly in view of her costume?
I'll have a talk with him, Sparhawk promised.
By hand, Mirtai suggested. Sometimes it's a little hard to get Colton's attention when he's distracted. She's vulgar, Baroness Melodir sniffed. She's very pretty, though, Baroness, Aelene added, and she's not really flaunting her body. She knows it's there, of course, but I think she just likes to share it with people. She's generous more than vulgar.
Do you suppose we could talk about something else? Sparhawk asked
them in a pained tone. There was a light knock on the door, and Mirtai went to see who was asking admittance. As always, the Etana had one hand on a dagger hilt when she opened the door. It was Oscania. He was wearing a hooded cloak, and he was accompanied by another man similarly garbed. The two stepped inside quickly. "Close the door, Etana," the ambassador hissed urgently, his usually imperturbable face stunned, and his eyes wild.
"What's your problem, Oscania?" she asked bluntly.
"Please, Etana Mirtai, close the door. If anybody finds out that my friend and I are here, the palace will fall down around our ears." She closed the door and bolted it. A sudden, absolute certainty came over Sparhawk, and he rose to his feet.
"Welcome, Your Imperial Majesty," he greeted Oscania's hooded companion.
Emperor Sarabian pushed back his hood.
"How the deuce did you know it was me, Prince Sparhawk?" he asked.
His Alenic was only slightly accented.
"I know you couldn't see my face."
"No, Your Majesty," Sparhawk replied, "but I could see Ambassador Oscania's. He looked very much like a man holding a live snake."
"I've been called a lot of things in my time," Sarabian laughed, "but never that."
"Your Majesty is most skilled," Elana told him with a little curtsy. "I didn't see a single hint on your face that you understood Alenic. I could read it in Queen Betuana's face, but you didn't give me a single clue."
"Betuana speaks Alenic?"
He seemed startled. "What an astounding thing." He removed his cloak.
"Actually, Your Majesty," he told Elana, "I speak all the languages of the Empire. Tamil, Alenic, Syriac, Tegan, Arjunai, Valesian, and even the awful language they speak in Semesca. It's one of our most closely guarded state secrets. I even keep it a secret from my government, just to be on the safe side." He looked a bit amused.
"I gather that you'd all concluded that I'm not quite bright," he suggested.
"You fooled us completely, Your Majesty,"
Melodir assured him. He beamed at her.
"Delightful girl," he said. "I adore fooling people. There are many reasons for this subterfuge, my friends, but they're mostly political and not really very nice. Shall we get to the point here? I can only be absent for a short period of time without being missed."
"We are, as they say, at your immediate disposal, Your Majesty," Elana told him.
"I've never understood that phrase, Elana," he confessed. "You don't mind if we call each other by name, do you? All those Your Majesties are just too cumbersome.
Where was I?
Oh, yes, immediate disposal. It sounds like someone running to carry out the trash."
His words seemed to tumble from his lips as if his tongue were having difficulty keeping up with his thoughts. "The point of this visit, my dear friends, is that I'm more or less the prisoner of custom and tradition here in Matherian. My role is strictly defined, and for me to overstep certain bounds causes earthquakes that can be felt from here to the Gulf of Daconia. I could ignore those earthquakes, but our common enemy could probably feel them too, and we don't want to alert him."
"Truly," Sparhawk agreed.
"Please don't keep gaping at me like that, Oscania," Sarabian told the ambassador. "I didn't tell you that I was really awake when most of you thought I was sleeping, because it wasn't necessary for you to know before. Now it is. Snap out of it, man. The foreign minister has to be able to take these little surprises in stride."
"It's just taking me a little while to readjust my thinking, Your Majesty."
"You thought I was an idiot, am I right?"
"Well, you were supposed to think so, Oscania. You and Subhat and all the other ministers. It's been one of my main defenses and amusements. Actually, old boy, I'm something of a genius." He smiled at Elana. "That sounds immodest, doesn't it? But it's true, nonetheless. I learned your language in 3 weeks, and Styric in 4. I can find the logical fallacies in the most abstruse treatise on Aline theology. And I've probably read and understood just about everything that's ever been written. My most brilliant achievement, however, has been to keep all that a secret. The people who call themselves my government, no offense intended, Oscania, seem to be engaging in some vast conspiracy to keep me in the dark. They only tell me things they think I'll want to hear. I have to look out a window to get an accurate idea of the current weather. They have the noblest of motives, of course. They want to spare me any distress. But I really think that someone ought to tell me when the ship I'm riding in is sinking, don't you?" Sarabian was still talking very fast, spilling out ideas as quickly as they came to him. His eyes were bright, and he seemed almost on the verge of laughing out loud. He was obviously tremendously excited.
Now then, he rushed on, we must devise a means of communicating without alerting everyone in the palace, down to and including the scullery boys in the kitchen, to what we're doing. I desperately need to know what's really going on, so that I can bring my towering intellect to bear on it. That last was delivered with self-deprecating irony. Any ideas?
What are your feelings about magic, Your Majesty?
Sparhawk asked him. I haven't formed an opinion yet, Sparhawk.
It won't work, then, Sparhawk told him. You have to believe that the spell's going to work, or it'll fail.
I might be able to make myself believe, Sarabian said, just a bit dubiously.
That probably wouldn't do it, Your Majesty, Sparhawk told him. The spells would succeed or not, depending on your mood. We need something a bit more certain. There are things we'll need to tell you that will be so important that we won't be able to just trust to luck.
My feelings exactly, Sparhawk. That defines our problem, then. We need an absolutely certain method of passing information back and forth that can't be detected. My experience tells me that it has to be something so commonplace that nobody will pay any attention to it. Exchange gifts, Baroness Melodir suggested in an offhand way. I'd be delighted to send you gifts, my dear Baroness, Sarabian smiled. Your eyes quite stop my heart, but... She held up one hand. Excuse me, Your Majesty, she told him, but nothing is more common than the exchange of gifts between ruling monarchs. I can carry little mementos from the Queen to you, and the ambassador here can carry yours to her. After we've run back and forth a few times, nobody will pay any attention to us. We can conceal messages in those gifts, and no one will dare to search for them. Where did you find this wonderful girl, Elana? Sarabian demanded. I'd marry her in a minute, if I didn't already have 9 wives. Oh, incidentally, Sparhawk, I need to talk with you about that. Privately, perhaps. He looked around. Can anyone see any flaws in the Baroness' plan?
Just one, Mirtai said. But I can take care of that.
What is it, Etana? The excited Emperor asked.
Someone may still have suspicions about this exchange of gifts, particularly if there's a steady stream of them. He might try to intercept Melodir, but I'll escort her back and forth. I'll personally guarantee that no one will interfere.
Excellent, Etana. Capital. We'd better get back, Oskanya. Subhat misses me terribly when I'm not where he expects me to be. Oh, Sparhawk, please designate several of your knights to entertain my wife, Elisun.
I beg your Majesty's pardon?
Young, preferably handsome, and with lots of stamina. You know the type.
Are we talking about what I think we're talking about, Your Majesty?
Of course we are. Elisun enjoys exchanging gifts and favors, too, and she'd be crushed if no one wanted to play with her. She's terribly shrill when she's unhappy. For the sake of my ears, please see to it, old boy.
How many, Your Majesty?
A dozen or so should suffice, I expect. Coming, Oskanya? And the Emperor of Tamale rushed to the door. Chapter 25.
It's a characteristic of people with a certain level of intelligence, Your Majesty, Zalasta advised Elana. They talk very fast because their ideas are spilling over. Emperor Sarabian may not be quite as brilliant as he thinks he is, but his is a mind to be reckoned with. The amazing thing is that he's managed to keep it a secret from everybody in his government. Those people are usually so erratic and excitable that they trip themselves up.
They were all gathered in the royal apartment to discuss the previous night's startling revelation. Ambassador Oskanya had arrived early, bringing with him a diagram of the hidden passageways and concealed listening posts inside the Aline castle that was their temporary home. A half-dozen spies had been rooted out and politely but firmly invited to leave.
"There's nothing really personal involved, Your Majesty," Oskanya apologized to Elana. "It's just a matter of policy."
"I understand completely, Your Excellency," she replied graciously. Elana wore an emerald-green gown this morning, and she looked particularly lovely.
"Is your espionage system very well developed, Your Excellency?" Stragan asked.
"No, not really, my lord. Each bureau of the government has its spies, but they spend most of their time spying on each other. We are far more nervous about our colleagues than we are about foreign visitors."
"There's no centralized intelligence service, then?"
"I'm afraid not, my lord."
"Are we sure we cleaned all the spies out?" Amban asked, looking a bit nervously at the gleaming walls.
"Trust me, Your Grace,"
Sifrinia smiled.
"I didn't follow that, I'm afraid."
"She wiggled her fingers, Patriarch Amban," Talon said dryly. She turned all the spies we didn't catch into toads.
Well, not exactly, she amended. But if there are any spies left hiding behind the walls, they can't hear anything. You're a very useful person to have around, Zephrenia, the fat little churchman observed.
I've noticed that myself, Vanyan agreed.
Let's push on here, Alana suggested. We don't want to overuse our subterfuge, but we will want to exchange a few gifts with Sarabian, just to make sure that no one's going to intercept our messages, and to get the courtiers in the hallways accustomed to seeing Melodir trotting back and forth with trinkets. I won't really trot, Your Majesty, Melodir objected. I'll swish, seductively. I've found that a man who's busy watching your hips doesn't pay too much attention to what the rest of you is doing.
Really?
Princess Danae said. I'll have to remember that. Can you show me how to swish, Baroness?
You're going to have to grow some hips first, Princess, Talon told her.
Danae's eyes went suddenly dangerous.
Never mind, Sparhawk told her.
She ignored him. I'll get you for that, Talon, she threatened.
I doubt it, Your Highness, he replied impudently. I can still run faster than you can.
We have another problem, Stragan told them. The absolutely splendid plan I conceived some months ago fell all to pieces on me last night. The local thieves aren't going to be much help, I'm afraid. They're even worse than Kaalador led us to believe back in Libus. Tommel society's so rigid that my colleagues out there in the streets can't think independently. There's a certain way that thieves are supposed to behave here, and the ones we met last night are so hidebound that they can't get around the stereotypes. The Alenes in the local thieves' community are creative enough, but the Tommels are hopelessly inept.
That's certainly the truth, Talon agreed. They don't even try to run when they're caught stealing. They just stand around, waiting to be taken into custody. It's the most immoral thing I've ever heard of.
We might be able to salvage something out of it, Stragan continued. I've sent for Kaalador. Maybe he can talk some sense into them. What concerns me the most is their absolute lack of any kind of organization. The thieves don't talk to the murderers, the whores don't talk to the beggars, and nobody talks to the swindlers. I can't for the life of me see how they survive.
That's bad news, Olaf noted. We were counting on the thieves to serve as our spy network.
Let's hope that Kaalador can fix it, Stragan said. The fact that there's no central intelligence gathering apparatus in the government makes those thieves crucial to our plans.
Kaalador will be able to talk some sense into them, Alana said. I have every confidence in him.
That's probably because you like to hear him talk, Sparhawk told her.
Speaking of talking, Sephrenia said, I think our efforts here are going to be limited by the fact that most of you don't speak Tamil. We're going to have to do something about that.
Colton groaned.
It won't be nearly as painful this time, dear one, she smiled. We don't really have the time for you to actually learn the language, so Zelasta and I are going to cheat.
Could you clarify that a bit for me, Sephrenia? Amban said, looking puzzled.
We'll cast a spell.
She shrugged.
Are you trying to say that you can teach somebody a foreign language by magic?
He asked.
Oh, yes, Sparhawk assured him. She taught me to speak troll in about 5 seconds in Gwerig's cave, and I'd imagine that troll's a lot harder to learn than Tommel. At least Tommels are human.
We'll have to be careful, though, the small Styric woman cautioned. If you all appear to be linguistic geniuses, it's going to look very curious. We'll do it a bit at a time. A basic vocabulary and a rudimentary grammar right at first, and then we'll expand on that. I could send you instructors, Lady Sephrenia, Oskania offered. No thanks all the same, Your Excellency. Your instructors would be startled and suspicious if they suddenly found a whole platoon of extraordinarily gifted students. We'll do it ourselves in order to conceal what we're up to. I'll give our pupils here abominable accents right at first, and then we'll smooth things out as we go along.
Sophrenia, Colton said in a slightly resentful tone.
Yes, dear one?
You can teach people languages by magic?
Yes.
Then why did you spend all those years trying to teach me Styric? When you saw that it wasn't going to work, why didn't you just wiggle your fingers at me?
Colton, dear, she said gently, why was I trying to teach you Styric?
So that I could perform magic tricks, I guess. He shrugged. That's unless you just enjoy making people suffer.
No, dear one. It was just as painful for me as it was for you.
She shuddered.
More painful, probably. You were, in fact, trying to learn Styric so that you could work the spells. But in order to do that, you have to be able to think in Styric. You can't just mouth the words and make them come off the way you want them to.
Wait a minute, he objected. Are you saying that people who speak other languages don't think the same way we do?
They may think the same way, but they don't think in the same words.
Do you mean to say that we actually think in words?
Of course we do. What did you think thoughts were?
I don't know, but we're all human. Wouldn't we all think the same way and in the same language? She blinked.
And which language would that be, dear one?
Hellenic, naturally. That's why foreigners aren't as clever as we are. They have to stop and translate their thoughts from Hellenic into that barbarian gabble they call language. They do it just to be stubborn, of course. She stared at him suspiciously.
You're actually serious, aren't you?
Of course. I thought everybody knew that's why Hellenes are smarter than everybody else.
His face shone with blinding sincerity. Oh, dear, she sighed in near despair. Melodir put on a lavender gown and swished off to the Emperor's private apartments, bearing a blue satin Hellene doublet over one arm. Mirtai followed her. Mirtai did not swish. Melodir's eyes were ingenuously wide. Her expression was vapid. Her lower lip was adorably caught between her teeth, as if she were breathless with excitement. Emperor Sarabian's courtiers watched the swishing with great interest. Nobody paid the slightest attention to what she did with her hands. She delivered the gift to the Emperor with a breathy little speech, which Mirtai translated. The Emperor responded quite formally. Melodir curtsied, and then swished back to the Hellene castle. The courtiers still concentrated on the swishing, even though they had already had plenty of opportunity to observe the process.
It went off without a hitch, the Baroness reported smugly.
Did they enjoy the swishing? Stragan asked her.
I turned the entire court to stone, Milord Stragan.
She laughed. Did she really? He asked Mirtai.
Not entirely, the Aetana replied. A number of them followed her so that they could see more. Melodir's a very good swisher. What was going on inside her gown looked much like two cats fighting inside a burlap sack. We should use the talents God gave us, wouldn't you say, Your Grace?
The blonde girl asked Emban with mock piety.
Absolutely, my child,
he agreed, without so much as cracking a smile. Ambassador Oscania arrived about 15 minutes later, bearing an alabaster box on a blue velvet cushion. Aelana took the Emperor's note out of the box.
Aelana, she read aloud, your message arrived safely. I get the impression that the members of my court will not merely refrain from interfering with the Baroness as she moves through the halls, but will passionately defend her right to do so. How does the girl manage to move so many things all at the same time? Signed, Sarabian.
Well, Stragan asked the honey-blonde girl, how do you?
It's a gift, Milord Stragan.
The visiting Hellenes made some show of receiving instruction in the Tamil language for the next few weeks, and Oscania helped their subterfuge along by casually advising various members of the government that he had been teaching the visitors the language during their long journey. Aelana made a brief speech in Tamil at one of the banquets the Prime Minister had arranged for the guests, in order to establish the fact that she and her party had already achieved a certain level of proficiency. There were awkward moments, of course. On one occasion, Colton grossly offended a courtier when he smilingly delivered what he thought to be a well-turned compliment.
What's the matter with him?
The blonde Pandion asked, looking puzzled as the courtier stalked away.
What were you trying to say to him?
Mirtai asked, stifling a laugh. I told him that I was pleased to see that he was smiling, Carlton replied.
That's not what you said.
Well, what did I say?
You said, may all of your teeth fall out.
I used the wrong word for smiling, right?
I'd say so, yes.
The pretense of learning a new language provided the Queen and her entourage with a great deal of leisure time. The official functions and entertainments they were obliged to attend usually took place in the evening, and that left the days generally free. They passed those hours in idle conversation, conducted for the most part in Tamil. The spell Sophronia and Zelasta had woven gave them all a fairly complete understanding of vocabulary and syntax, but the smoothing out of pronunciation took somewhat longer. As Oscania had predicted he would, the Prime Minister threw obstacles in their paths at every turn. Insofar as he could, he filled their days with tedious and largely meaningless activities. They attended the openings of cattle shows. They were awarded honorary degrees at the university. They visited model farms. He provided them with huge escorts whenever they left the imperial compound, escorts that usually took several hours to form up. Pandya Subhat's agents put that time to good use, clearing the streets of precisely the people the visitors wanted to see. Most troublesome, however, was the fact that he severely restricted their access to Emperor Saravian. Subhat made himself as inconvenient as he possibly could, but he was unprepared for a lean ingenuity, and the fact that many in their party were not entirely what they seemed to be. Talon, in particular, seemed to completely baffle the Prime Minister's agents. As Sparhawk had noticed long ago, it was quite nearly impossible to follow Talon in any city in the world. The young man had a great deal of fun, and gathered a great deal of information. On one drowsy afternoon, Elana and the ladies were in the royal apartment, and the Queen's maid, Aileen, was speaking, as Carlton and Sparhawk quietly entered.
"It's not uncommon," the doe-eyed girl was saying quietly. "It's one of the inconveniences of being a servant."
As usual, Aileen wore a severe dress of muted gray.
"Who was he?" Elana's eyes were like flint.
"It's not really important, Your Majesty," Aileen replied, looking slightly embarrassed.
"Yes, Aileen," Elana disagreed. "It is."
"It was Count Osril, Your Majesty."
"I've heard of him."
Elana's tone was frosty.
"So have I."
Melodir's tone was just as cold.
"I gather that the Count's reputation is unsavory?"
Sophronia asked.
"He's what's referred to as a rake, Lady Sophronia,"
Melodir replied.
"He wallows in debauchery of the worst kind. He boasts that he's saving God all the inconvenience of condemning him, since he was born to go to hell anyway." "My parents were country people," Aileen continued, "so they didn't know about the Count's reputation. They thought that placing me in service to him would give me the opportunity of a lifetime. It's the only real chance a peasant has for advancement. I was 14, and very innocent. The Count seemed friendly at first, and I considered myself lucky. Then he came home drunk one night, and I discovered why he'd been so nice to me. I hadn't received the kind of training Mirtai had, so there was nothing I could do. I cried afterward, of course, but all he did was laugh at my tears. Fortunately, nothing came of it. Count Osril customarily turned pregnant maids out with nothing but the clothes on their backs. After a few times, he grew tired of the game. He paid me my salary and gave me a good recommendation. I was fortunate enough to find employment at the palace." She smiled a tight, hurt little smile. "Since there were no after effects, I suppose it doesn't really matter all that much." "It does to me," Mirtai said bleakly. "You have my word that he won't survive my return to Simura by more than a week."
"If you're going to take that long, you'll miss your chance, Mirtai," Carlton told her almost casually. "Count Osril won't see the sunset of the day when I get back to Simura, I promise you." "He won't fight you, Carlton," Sparhawk told his friend. "He won't have any choice," Carlton replied. "I know any number of insults that no man can swallow, and if they don't work, I'll start slicing pieces off him.
If you cut off a man's ears and nose, he almost has to reach for his sword, probably because he doesn't know what you plan to cut off next. You'll get arrested.
That's no problem, Sparhawk, Elana said grimly. I'll pardon him. You don't have to do that, Sir Calton, Aileen murmured, her eyes downcast.
Yes, Calton replied in a stony voice. As a matter of fact, I do. I'll bring you one of his ears after I've finished with him, just to prove that I've kept my promise.
Sparhawk fully expected the gentle girl to react with violent revulsion to her protector's brutal offer. She did not, however. She smiled warmly at Sparhawk's friend. That would be very nice, Sir Calton, she said.
Go ahead, Sophronia, Sparhawk said to his tutor. Roll your eyes and sigh. I might even agree with you this time.
Why should I do that, Sparhawk? She asked. I think Sir Calton's come up with a very appropriate course of action.
You're a savage, little mother, he accused.
So?
Later that afternoon, Sparhawk and Calton had joined the other knights in the gleaming great hall of the counterfeit Aline Castle. The knights had put aside their formal armor, and now wore doublets and hose.
It wouldn't take very much, Sir Bevier was saying. The walls are really very sturdy, and the fosse is already in place. The drawbridge is functional, though the capstans that raise it need some grease. All we really need to finish it off are sharpened stakes in the fosse.
And a few barrels of pitch, Ulof suggested. I know how much you Archeans enjoy pouring boiling pitch on people. Gentlemen, Vanyan said disapprovingly, if you start reinforcing the defenses of this place, our hosts may take it the wrong way.
He thought about it for a moment.
It might not hurt to quietly lay in a goodly supply of stakes, though, he added, and maybe a number of barrels of lamp oil. It's not quite as good as pitch, but it won't attract so much attention when we bring it inside. I think we might also want to start unobtrusively bringing in provisions. There are quite a lot of us, so concealing the fact that we're filling storerooms shouldn't be too hard. Let's keep it all fairly low-key, though.
What are you contemplating, Vanyan? Amban asked him.
Just a few simple precautions, Your Grace. Things are unstable here in Tomoli, and we have no way of knowing what might happen. Since we've got a perfectly good castle, we might just as well give it a few finishing touches, just in case.
Is it just my imagination, or does it seem to anybody else that this is a very, very long summer? Tinian asked suddenly. Sparhawk became very alert. Someone had been bound to notice that eventually, and if they really pursued the matter and started counting days, they'd be certain to uncover the fact that someone had been tampering with time.
It's a different part of the world, Tinian, he said easily. The climate's bound to be different.
Summer is summer, Sparhawk, and it's not supposed to last forever.
You can never tell about climate, Ulof disagreed, particularly along a seacoast. There's a warm current that runs up the west coast of Thalesia. It can be the dead of winter in Yosat on the east coast, and only mid-autumn in Horset.
Good old Ulof, Sparhawk thought with some relief. It still seems a little strange to me, Tinian said dubiously.
Lots of things seem strange to you, my friend, Ulof smiled. You've turned down any number of invitations I've sent you to go ogre hunting with me.
Why kill them if you're not going to eat them? Tinian shrugged.
You didn't eat any of those Zemoks you killed.
I didn't have a good recipe for cooking them.
They all laughed and let the subject drop, and Sparhawk breathed a bit easier. Talon came into the hall then. As usual, he had almost routinely shaken off the agents of the Prime Minister that morning and gone out into the city.
Surprise, surprise, he said dryly. Krager's finally made it to Mathurian. I was starting to worry about him. That does it, Sparhawk burst out, slamming his fist down on the arm of his chair. That man's starting to make me very tired.
We didn't really have the time to chase him down before, my lord, Khalad pointed out. Maybe we should have taken the time. I was sure of that when we saw him back in Sarsos. We're settled in now, though, so let's devote a little time and energy to rooting him out. Draw some pictures of him, Talon. Spread them around and promise a reward. I know how to go about it, Sparhawk. Do it, then. I want to put my hands on that drunken little weasel. There's all kinds of information inside that sodden skin of his, and I'm going to wring him out until I've got the very last drop of it.
Testy, isn't he? Tinian said mildly to Calton.
He's been having a bad day, Calton shrugged. He discovered a streak of brutality in his womenfolk, and it upset him.
Oh?
There's a nobleman in Samora who needs killing. When I get home, I'm going to slice off his cods before I butcher him. The ladies all thought it was a wonderful idea. Their approval shattered a number of Sparhawk's illusions.
What's the fellow done?
It's a private matter.
Oh. Well, at least Sephrenia agreed with our illustrious leader.
Now, as a matter of fact, she was even more bloodthirsty than the rest. She went so far as to offer some suggestions later on that even made Nirtai turn pale.
The fellow really must have done something awful.
He did indeed, my friend. And I'm going to give him hours and hours to regret it.
Calton's blue eyes were like ice, and his nostrils were white and pinched with suppressed fury.
I didn't do it, Calton, Tinian told him, so don't start looking at me like that.
Sorry, Calton apologized. Just thinking about it makes my blood boil.
Don't think about it, then.
Their accents were still rough. Sephrenia had seen to that. But their understanding of the Tamil language was very nearly perfect.
Are we ready? Sparhawk asked his tutor one evening.
Unless you plan to make speeches, Prince Sparhawk, said Emperor Sarabian, who was paying them another of those whirlwind visits. Your accent is really vile, you know.
I'm going out there to listen, Your Majesty, Sparhawk told him. Not to talk.
Sephrenia and Zalasta are hiding our proficiency behind the accents. I wish you'd told me you could do this, Zalasta. Sarabian said, just a bit wistfully. You could have saved me months of time when I was studying languages, you know.
Your Majesty was keeping your studies a secret, Zalasta reminded him. I didn't know you wanted to learn other tongues.
Caught by my own cleverness, then. Sarabian shrugged. Oh, well, what precisely are we planning?
We are going to winnow through your court, Your Majesty, Vanyan told him.
Your government's compartmentalized, and your ministers keep secrets from each other. That means that no one really has a grasp of the whole picture. We are going to fan out through the various departments and gather up everything we can find. When we put it all together, we might be able to see some patterns starting to emerge.
Sarabian made a sour face. It's my own fault, he confessed.
Please don't be cryptic, Sarabian, Ilana told him. The two monarchs were good friends by now, largely because the Emperor had simply pushed all formalities aside. He had spoken directly, and had insisted that Ilana do the same. I blundered, Ilana, he said ruefully. Tamalese never faced a real crisis before. Our bureaucrats are more clever than the subject peoples, and they have the Etons to back them up. The Imperial family's always been more afraid of its own government than of outsiders. We don't encourage cooperation between the various ministries. I seem to be reaping the fruit of a misguided policy. When this is all over, I think I'll fix it.
My government doesn't keep secrets from me, Ilana told him smugly.
Please don't rub it in, he said.
What exactly are we looking for, Lord Vanyan?
We observed a number of phenomena on our way to Mathurian. Our guess is that we're facing an alliance of some sort. We know, or at least we have good evidence, about who one of the parties is. We need to concentrate on the other now. We're at a distinct disadvantage until we can identify him. If it's all right with you, Your Majesty, Queen Ilana and Prince Sparhawk will be spending a great deal of time with you. That means that you're going to have a long talk with your Prime Minister, I'm afraid. Pandya Subat's starting to be inconvenient. Sarabian raised one eyebrow questioningly. He's done everything he possibly can to make you inaccessible to us, Sarabian, Ilana explained.
He was told not to do that, Sarabian said bleakly.
Apparently he didn't listen, Your Majesty, Sparhawk said. We have to wade through his people whenever we get near the main palace, and every time one of us so much as sticks his head out a window,
whole platoons of spies start to form up to follow us. Your Prime Minister doesn't approve of us, I gather.
It rather looks as if I'm going to have to explain some things to the esteemed Pandya Subat, Sarabian said. I think he's forgotten the fact that his office isn't hereditary, and that his head's not so firmly attached that I can't have it removed if he starts to inconvenience me. What charges would you bring against him, Sarabian? Ilana asked curiously.
Charges? What on earth are you talking about, Ilana? This is Tomalee. I don't need charges. I can have his head chopped off if I decide that I don't like his haircut. I'll take care of Pandya Subat, my friends. I can promise his complete cooperation from now on, either his or that of his successor. Please continue, Lord Vanyan.
Vanyan pushed on.
Patriarch Amban will concentrate his attention on the Prime Minister, he said, whoever he happens to be. Sir Bevier will spend his time with the faculty of the university. Scholars pick up a great deal of information, and governments tend to ignore their findings, until it's too late. Ulaf, Krang, and Tinian will observe the general staff of the army, the Tamil High Command, rather than the Etons. Etan and Gessa will cover his own people. Milord Stragan and Talon will serve as liaison with the thieves of Mathurian, and Aileen and Khalad will circulate among the palace servants. Sifrinia and Zalasta will talk with the local Stira community, and Meladir and Sir Barret will charm all the courtiers. Isn't Sir Barret just a bit young? Sarabian asked. My courtiers are a very sophisticated group of people.
Sir Barret has some special qualifications, Your Majesty, Meladir smiled. The younger women of your court, and some not quite so young, will do almost anything for him. He may have to sacrifice his virtue a few times, but he's a very dedicated young man, so I'm sure we can count on him.
Barret blushed.
Why do you always have to say things like that, Baroness? He asked plaintively. I'm only teasing, Barret, she said fondly.
It's something that men don't understand, Your Majesty, Carlton told the Emperor. Barret has a strange effect on young women for some reason. Carlton and Mirtai will attend Sparhawk and the Queen, Vanyan continued. We don't know exactly how far our opponents might be willing to go, so they'll provide you with some additional protection. And you, Lord Vanyan? The Emperor asked.
Vanyan and Oscania are going to try to put it all together, Sarabian, Ilana replied. We'll all bring everything we find directly to them. They'll sort through it all and isolate the gaps, so that we'll know where to concentrate further efforts.
You Alines are a very methodical people, Sarabian noted.
It's an outgrowth of their dependency on logic, Your Majesty, Sifrinia told him. Their plodding search for corroboration is maddening sometime, but it does get results. A well-trained Aline will spend half a day making observations before he'll allow himself to admit that it's raining.
Ah, Emban said to her,
but when an Aline says that it's raining, you can be absolutely sure that he's telling you the truth.
And what about you, Your Highness? Sarabian smiled down at the little girl in his lap. What part are you going to play in this grand scheme?
I'm supposed to distract you, so that you don't ask too many questions, Sarabian,
Danae replied quite calmly.
Your new friends are going to do things that aren't really proper, so I'm supposed to keep you from noticing.
Danae, her mother exclaimed.
Well, aren't you? You're going to lie to people and spy on them and probably kill anybody who gets in your way. Isn't that what you mean when you use the word politics?
Sarabian laughed.
I think she's got you there, Ilana,
he chortled. Her definition of politics is a little blunt, but it's very close to the mark. She's going to make an excellent queen.
Thank you, Sarabian, Danae said sweetly, kissing his cheek.
Then Sparhawk felt that sudden chill, and even though he knew it was useless, his hand went to his sword hilt as the flicker of darkness tugged at the very corner of his vision. He started to swear, half in Alenic and half in Tamil, as he realized that everything they had said had just been revealed to the shadowy presence that had been dogging their steps for all these months. End of Side 10. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.